supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, when we finally settle down with what we hope will be that perfect someone, we find we're really not alone in that relationship. With our new spouse comes a host of new relationships, experiences, and personalities in the form of their family members. Like it or not, we have a new mom and dad, brother and sister. But who are these people really? Their methods of living may be drastically different from our own. So now what? Do we stand up for ourselves and risk our values and risk alienating our spouse? Or do we just shut up and feel disloyal to our own families and their values? Well, can this ever really become one family? If so, how? Well, with me to answer all those questions and more is Terry Apter. She's a psychologist at the University of Cambridge in England and the author of What Do You Want From Me? Getting Along with Your In-Laws. Terry Apter, thank you for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure.
And if you, our listeners, want to join the conversation, if any of you may have issues with your in-laws of either generation, give us a call. It's 888-477-9499. I strongly suggest calling early in the show. Our lines might be filled. That's 1-888-477-9499. Well, Terry Apter, in-law problems are so universal, there must be something in our hard wiring that makes these relationships difficult. I mean, after all, we used to just marry within the clan. That made things easier at a certain level.
Well, marrying within the clan is a way of marrying within your family. I mean, marriage in some form is a feature of every known society, and it presents us with a paradox. Marriage is necessary to the continuation of the family. That's how children are born. But it also threatens family solidarity, because what normally happens is that when you marry, you introduce outsiders into the family. And that can destabilize or threaten the cohesiveness of the family. So, you know, marrying within the clan, marrying within your family is a way of marrying, but and having a partner so that you can generate children, but it also is a way of saying we're not really bringing an outsider into the family.
Yeah, and
well, we don't have that anymore. You know, we believe that individuals should make their own choices, and for a variety of reasons, they're going to choose someone who's a bit different from their own family.
Well, I want to talk about specifics about choice and who we choose and why. But I wonder in general why it's so difficult to allow outsiders into the clan. Some families are better at it than others. Families who I consider have these kind of more permeable boundaries rather than rigid ones. So who does it work better?
Well, I mean, there are many different ways of answering that. If you want to go from an evolutionary point of view, it's that someone who is someone becomes close to you, you has influence over your genetic offspring. Let's look at it from the parents-in-law point of view, but they're not themselves genetically linked to you. And so you're a little bit suspicious of them. In terms of boundaries, well, yes, some families are very rigid, and they think that you have to behave in a certain way, that you have to have a very specific set of values, that they can only accept a very narrow range of personalities, emotions, expressions, behavior. And so anyone who steps out of that very rigid or very narrow set of values will not be acceptable. But sometimes parents are also uneasy about no longer being their child's next of kin. That's what happens when, you know, your child marries. You as a parent are no longer your child's next of kin.
Well, that brings up all of the control issues, which may be the underpinnings of a lot of the conflict. I want to play a clip with you from one of my one of my favorite movies. I don't know if you saw the movie Monster in Law.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Well, we'll play a clip from this. This is a movie. This is a 2005 film that starred Jane Fonda and Jennifer Lopez. When Charlotte now gets engaged to Kevin Fields, his mother, Viola, a recently fired news anchor, acts like she's thrilled, but really she's plotting to break up their relationship and to retain her hold on her son. Well, she's determined to become the world's worst mother-in-law in order to scare Charlotte away. So, in this scene, Charlotte and Viola meet for lunch, and Viola starts talking about her plans for Charlotte's wedding.
Now about the wedding, the two of you are going to arrive in a horse and carriage, and the driver's top hat will match the horse's saddles and the ribbons on the doves that will be released at the exact moment of I do. Hmm? And I've been in touch with your bridesmaids.
How do you know their names?
Well, Kevin told me. And I think for the honeymoon, St. Bart's is the absolute best place for you to go because Kevin adores it.
Hey, hold on. Just wait a minute, okay? No. Thank you, but no to everything. No to the horse and buggy, no to the top hats and to the doves and geese and any other farm animals you're thinking of using that day, and definitely no to you planning our honeymoon. What?
Oh no, I can. Oh.
What's wrong?
Oh.
No.
My
what?
Pills.
What?
My pills.
Okay, well let me help you.
Oh.
What are you... Viola.
Oh,
yes.
Oh no.
Hey, Viola.
Oh. Oh.
Viola. Viola.
Monster-in-law. The 2005 film that starred Jane Fonda and Jennifer Lopez. We are talking about our in-laws with Terry Apter, who's a psychologist with the University of Cambridge in England. She's recently written What Do You Want From Me? Learning to Get Along with Your In-Laws. Our number here is 888-477-9499. Maybe you are making holiday plans that involve your in-laws, or maybe you have ongoing conflict that never got voiced with your in-laws. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Well, Terry, back to this this film, Monster-in-Law. It really does bring up the issue you brought up before. It's the issue of control and letting go of our child. It's so much.
Well, I think it's extremely complicated because it's not just control. You know, here in this film, there's Jane Fonda, who has just been fired from her very prestigious employment position, and she's a middle-aged woman, and there are lots of losses in her lives. In her life, you know, she's lost her job. She feels she's getting older, and she's now worried about losing her son. She does then absolutely try to control the wedding. She knows, though, that that's a very aggressive act. She knows that that's a way of marginalizing her daughter-in-law, saying her daughter-in-law isn't the one to make choices in the marriage, that she's the one who knows what her son wants, and she's the one who's going to give him what he wants. Now, I think there's some element in that for almost any woman who sees her son getting married. But it isn't only letting go. It's also needing reassurance, and people can learn. But they can be anxious. How is this change in my son's life and my relationship with him going to affect our attachment?
Do you think these questions are conscious?
Often not. Often, there's a range of things. There's such a range. Sometimes they're not at all conscious, and they will simply be expressed in terms of this fiancé or this spouse is not good enough for my child. I don't think this is going to be a happy marriage. You know, you don't even process your own anxiety. You just project your dissatisfaction onto your son-in-law or daughter-in-law.
And speaking of son-in-law and daughter-in-law, I want to bring up some gender issues too. Let's go to the phones first. We've got Amy on the line.
Hi.
Hi, Amy.
I wanted to ask your thoughts about it. Seems like in the relationships for my immediate family and my extended family, that men tend to give up their families more than women. My father remarried, my brother has a significant person in his life, and it seems like their families, like my father's married family and my brother's girlfriend's family, are the families that take precedence. And I just seems like that happens so much in some of the people that I know, that the women's families become the majority of holidays and things
and,
like that.
And what about in your case, Amy?
How do you mean?
Well, are you in a relationship?
I'm married.
And is that the case with you and your husband?
I don't think so. I used to be super close with my father and my brother, and but as they've gotten involved with their families, it isn't really, there's nothing left to compete with, really. So I would have to say that now I think it's equal time. But I just think that a lot of the times, I think that, you know, in my brother's case, like, his girlfriend plans the event, so it becomes her family. Or my father's wife, she plans the event, so it becomes her family for the holidays and things like that. And I see that with some of my friends. It's the women's families that become, I think, dominant.
So let's see.
This is extremely interesting because in previous societies and in some societies today, it's the man's family that is the dominant family, and the woman actually has to give up, in marrying, has to give up her family entirely and go and live with the husband's family. But what Amy is pointing out is that the women are the kin, in our society, the women are the kin keepers. They plan family events, they remember important birthdays or important points of celebration for the family. And the fact that women play such a strong role in family cohesion is one reason why the husband's parents are more worried when their son gets married, more worried about what will happen to their relationship. They know that the daughter-in-law will have a lot of power in setting up family events, in maintaining or not maintaining family ties.
I want to focus on something you just said. And Amy, we're going to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for calling in and the important issues that you brought up. And by the way, the number is 888-477-9499. If you've got a story to tell about whether you are the in-law, well, you're always the in-law, whether you're the parent-in-law or the child-in-law. We'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. So, Terry, I want to come back to something you said. You said it is the male's parents who worry most about losing the child. But I wonder if we could get even more specific, and I wonder if it is the male's mother more than the male's father that worries more, and here we are back. back to the mother-in-law issues, mother-in-law, daughter-in-law. Yes, that's the major source of conflict I see.
The major source of conflict is between the mother-in-law and the daughter-in-law. So it is the husband's mother. Part of it is that the men are not as good at reassuring a mother, look, I'm changing, I'm grown up and I have my own family and another woman is now my wife, my most significant other. Men are less good at saying to a mother, this has changed, but I'm still going to be attached to you. The women, the man's wife, is better at reassuring her family, both her mother and her father, yes, I've changed, yes, I've grown up, I have other ties, but I'm still going to see you, I'm still going to check in with you, we're still going to have a close relationship. And so her parents don't feel so threatened. They don't feel that the marriage will ensue in a loss of the relationship.
Well, I would also, see, now we're generalizing here, and I hope
and
the audience bears with me, but she is often better at walking the walk, too. You know, he could reassure his mother, but, you know, not be able to stand up to his mother-in-law or you know, and
he can take a low profile during family visits. It's still, for all the change there's been, it's still much easier for a man in a family gathering to take a low profile,
especially a young man.
Well, I'm not sure that that age matters much in this respect, but you know, they can go off and do different things. Whereas, for all the change there's been, the way that a family is run, the way a house is presented, the way a meal is presented, the way the children are dressed, the way they behave at the table, the way that they behave around the house. All of this somehow seems to have a lot of symbolic meaning for the woman in the family. And if a mother-in-law comes in and may offer help, may offer suggestions, the woman in the family, the daughter-in-law, may feel, my mother-in-law is criticizing me, she's showing me she knows more about it than I do. The men in the family often don't even see these little competitions and discomforts.
They're off watching the football game on television.
Or even if they're in the room and participating, they don't notice the little slights, the little competitions as keenly as the women do. And of course, this can make a wife feel, as daughter-in-law, feel abandoned by her husband.
Right.
You know, why aren't you defending me? Whose side are you on?
And
why do you let her talk to me like that?
And as
and
both,
he'll say, well, that's just how she is. She didn't mean anything. Don't make a big deal about it.
And as many couples will report, the conversation going home at the end of the evening is typically pretty unpleasant.
And because in-law conflict can lead to marital conflict when you feel your spouse is not defending you and is protecting his own parents and not protecting you.
Well, let me ask you a quick but difficult question, right? We've got to take a break, but I just want to follow that up. What do you recommend? I mean, should we, I guess both spouses, protect our spouse in when we're in conflict with the parental generation? Is that a generalization?
It's a generalization that you're supposed to see things from your spouse's point of view. Now, some wives can make it very difficult for their husband to do that because they're just criticizing the mother-in-law, and that can be very difficult for the mother-in-law's son to take. But he can protect her by showing her affection, complimenting her in front of his mother, and by making sure his mother doesn't think it's all right to criticize his wife to him. Mm. So, yes, protect, but it doesn't mean protect the spouse, but it doesn't mean that you allow the spouse to attack the your own parents.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with loyalty to your parents.
We've got to take that aforementioned break. Terry, stick with us. We'll be back in just 60 seconds. Terry Apter is a psychologist at the University of Cambridge and England, where she specializes in studying teaching women's relationships to each other. She's also the author of What Do You Want From Me? Learning to Get Along with Your In-Laws. Our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Cooper University Hospital's Heart Institute is a proud supporter of WHYY, the only academic medical center in southern New Jersey. Cooper Heart Institute provides a full range of advanced cardiovascular care, from cardiac surgery to comprehensive testing and treatment from outpatient centers located throughout South Jersey. Details about Cooper Heart Institute programs and services are available at 1-800-8-COOPER or online at cooperheart.org.
The Clay Studio supports WHYY and shares its dedication to creative expression. This month, the Clay Studio features Gifted, an exhibition of handmade objects from 100 North American ceramic artists. The Clay Studio displays and sells distinctive art objects that can be used every day. Located in Old City, Philadelphia, at 137 North 2nd Street, open Tuesdays to Saturdays through January 3rd, 215-925-3453 or theclaystudio.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about our in-laws, something most people I know who are in an intimate relationship enjoy doing, talking about their in-laws. But we're doing it with an expert today. I'm joined by Terry Apter. She's a psychologist at the University of Cambridge in England, and she's the author of What Do You Want From Me? Learning to Get Along with Your In-Laws. Terry, I have a feeling our listeners and callers have been enjoying our discussion, and it really has been lovely and a bit theoretical, but I think they want us to get down to some concrete issues. So let's bring on the callers here, okay?
Sure.
We've got another Terry on the line. Terry, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi, Dr. Dan.
Hi.
To start off, I have a wonderful mother-in-law, just one of the nicest people in the world. But the challenge we run into is every year around the holidays, there's a family event that they have done for many years that's very large, very disorganized, really crazy, that's an ethnic event for their family. And with my mother-in-law getting a bit older, there is pressure by many people in the family, cousins and others, to push us to take over this event. And my husband doesn't want to do it, and neither do I, but it makes the day very difficult, and people are regularly going up to him and us saying, you need to do this. Why aren't you taking this over?
Why aren't you taking it over, and why do you need to do it?
Why are we not taking it over? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Okay. The reason is, one of the reasons to not take it over, it is a very crazy, difficult event that has very specific ethnic food, and many people, extended people, come in to do this. It would be very difficult for us to take it over and be able to do it. It's a pretty demanding event.
Is that the main reason?
Well, that and the other... And the other issue is it's so crazy and disorganized, and there's problems with his brother who lives at home who fights us the entire way. We can't even go over and help before to go over and help them at the event because he's so controlling and, like, won't even do anything and control and ends up in fights that it's very difficult around that time. So we don't want the event.
Yeah. So it's about sibling issues, and it seems like it's a question of saying no. What's the difficulty saying no?
We say no, But I know it. But the problem is, everyone, like many of the people that come to the event, feel a need to tell us why aren't we doing it, and explaining to us that it is our role and our responsibility, and pushing it on us.
Well, let's turn to Terry Apter. It seems like we're talking about not so much ethnic issues, but different family styles. And, you know, how do you...
Well, it's, you know, this is a fascinating dynamic here, because Terry has described both the request and expectation that she and her husband carry on a family tradition, which they don't even enjoy. And at the same time, she's described a brother-in-law who makes it very difficult for them to do anything, for them to help. And so the family is both saying, please do this, you should do this, and if you don't say yes, you'll feel guilty. And at the same time, they're or at least some of the members are making it very difficult for them to do anything at all. It's very confusing and double bind dynamic.
So what I am guessing here is that what we had was a very powerful matriarch who took control of everything and might have done things her way, but certainly did everything. And I hear the siblings asking for somebody to take charge and keep the homeostasis. And you know, that's the good news and bad news about having a powerful matriarch and patriarch. It really does create great difficulties when they lose or give up control.
But it also points out how problematic it can be to say no. Even when, you know, as you're pointing out to Terry, what's the problem with saying no? You know, you don't want to do this, just say no. And Terry says, well, when we do, we feel really bad. And, you know, that's a big problem in families. They people can make you feel really bad because you do care about them.
You have to
resist this. And, I mean, it sounds, the good thing is that it sounds as though Terry and her husband are on the same page.
Yeah, and at least they're clear. The one word we didn't use that you used in your book is about different norms in different families. And one of the things we're hearing in this conflict is when different norms bump up against each other. And perhaps in Terry's family, you don't say no. You know, perhaps you just don't do
it. That's right. Yes, but it's considered disrespectful, or, you know, you don't really have an option. But Terry and her husband are their own family, and, you know, they can say no.
Yeah.
They could think about that. They could turn to the people who are saying you should do this and say, well, you know, clearly it's very important to you, and I understand that. And the consequence seems to be that you, or the conclusion seems to be that you should do it.
Well, you
not
know,
me.
You know, as a clinician, I take a page out of, you know, the standard treatment for OCD and phobias. And that is to look very squarely at what you're afraid of, and ultimately do it. Do what you're afraid of, and that's the only way you can really be free of your fears. And if what you're afraid of is simply saying no, and you know, seeing what happens after that, then simply say no and find out that the family is more resilient than you fear, and so are you.
Yeah. But I think they also have to, Terry and her husband have to locate the fear.
Right.
I mean, is Terry being feeling her husband's fear, or does she also share it? And that's something that they can work at between themselves.
And certainly have the potential to. Terry, thanks so much for your call. It certainly led to a rich discussion. I want to bring up something about a perspective from the older generation, from the you know, when my daughters got married, I really cared only about whether these guys would love their daughters, their love my daughters and care for them. But to be honest with you, I wanted them to love my daughters the way I wanted them to love my daughters. And, and frankly, I thought these were nice guys, but were slugs. I wanted them to devote their lives to my kids, you know, and take care of them. I'm able to say that because my relationship with both of them is pretty good, number one. And number two, I know they're not listening to the show right now.
But that is, you know, we parents remain enormously protective of our children throughout their lives, however grown up they are and competent. And we want people, the person who is closest to them, to put them first always. It can be difficult to see that your son or daughter is compromising on behalf of her spouse. Now, she may want to do this. This may be the best thing for her ultimate happiness, but it makes a parent worried. And that's difficult for a son-in-law or daughter-in-law. You're joining a family. You're, as it were, a son or a daughter to your parents-in-law. And yet, you will never be as important to your parents-in-law as their child is. And so you will be in this family, but your needs and your wishes and your hopes will not be as important as to the parents-in-law as those of your spouse.
Yeah,
and that can be difficult.
I have to tell you, it was, and here we are some 12, 15 years later, remains extraordinarily difficult for me to keep my mouth shut when I know I'm supposed to. And I've only met that challenge with marginal success. But I do. And you know, I mean, deep down, I want these guys to love my daughters the way I loved them. Now, granted, over the years, my feelings about this have changed. They've softened as I truly have grown to love my sons-in-law, and I'm able to see them as people and not just vehicles to take care of my kids.
Well, that's the resolution, to be able to feel that, you know, your in-laws are good contributors to your family in their own right, and that you appreciate who they are. And that's what in-laws want of any generation. They want to be appreciated. They want their contribution to the family to be valued and acknowledged. And it sometimes takes a very long time for that to happen.
And you know what? Both generations want that. We need that from one another, because it's fraught with anxiety, these relationships. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Claire on the line. Hi, Claire. You're on Voices.
Hi, Dr. Dan. I am calling about my mother-in-law. I've been happily married for about 15 years. And really, since the inception of our marriage, one of the things that I have found is that my mother-in-law has really, because my husband comes from a very small family, there's only two children. I, on the other hand, I'm the youngest of six. We've come together through the years and have had a very great marriage, but what I have found in the past is that my mother-in-law has exercised undue influence at times, and I don't want to go into any lengthy examples, but I was thinking of one as I was on hold. One example, for instance, is when we were getting married. I came to the marriage a little bit more established financially, and we had decided to have a relatively small wedding, only going to be inviting about 75 people, and we were going to have it catered. We weren't going to have a traditional, what we call an Anglican marriage, though. We were going to have something less substantial. As a result of that decision that we made and the fact that I was paying for it, we took a lot of grief from my in-laws, to the point that my husband actually canceled the marriage. We continued to live together, and then when we left the country, we actually went and got married elsewhere out of the country. This is just sort of one example in the early stages. And I guess what the heart of my question comes down to is, in smaller families, when there's only two siblings and he's the only son, the other sibling is a daughter, is this normal to expect that sort of influence throughout the marriage? And I never had, my parents are now deceased. I never found they had that much, I never allowed that much influence, and I was wondering from family dynamics if there was a difference between the size of the families of the two people coming together.
Well, before we turn to Terry, I've got, you use the N-word, and I'm curious about that, normal.
Okay.
You use, and why do you wonder if this is normal?
Well, you know, I guess what I'm trying to decide is, and for the most part, you know, the decision that we made when we got all this heat is I love my husband to cancel the wedding, and we ended up eloping and getting married in another country. And I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, you know, I've made that decision. I don't look back on it and overly regret it. But what I'm trying to figure out is, at some point, is it worthwhile for me to try and stand my ground a little bit more on things rather than always go sort of giving in a little bit to my in-laws because, you know, they're older, they need that understanding, and to sort of in some ways be controlled by them continually.
Well, that's interesting because, Terry, I want to hear your reaction. My guess is the answer to your question is yes, Claire.
To Claire's question is yes, she should stand her ground. I think what's happened is that Claire's husband is responding to his own mother's need. Now, is the need greater for a specific child in a small family or a large family? Well, it's anyone's odds. It depends upon that particular relationship. But in this case, it does seem that Claire's husband does think that his mother has a special need for him, that he would be very uncomfortable and perhaps disloyal to her by standing up to his mother himself. On the other hand, he clearly has needs. He clearly wants to stand up. You know, he wants a separate life. He wants to marry Claire. And he has married Claire, but he needed her, really, to enforce the distance between him and his mother. I mean, sometimes we depend upon our in-laws to create the distance between our parents.
I have to tell you, I see that in my office all the time.
Yeah. So I think that, Claire and her husband decided to avoid the mother-in-law's claim, sort of go around the side, around the back, elope, and go to another country and get married, that it was just there was just going to be too much interference with any kind of direct confrontation. It's going to be very difficult to do that lifelong, and it will be much better to stand up to the mother-in-law and say, these are the decisions we make. These are the needs we have. This doesn't mean we're going to cast you off and not have anything to do with you. But in this area, I have to have I can't do with your interference. With your undue influence. It's not something I have to put up with. It's not something I should put up with. She'll also have to get her husband's help in doing that.
Well, I think she certainly needs to enlist her husband's help and support. And the other thing is, I mean, there's two ways you can stand up for yourself to someone else, two ways you can set boundaries. And one is with a clenched fist, and the other is with an open hand. And it's much better to do it with an open hand, with compassion for this woman, understanding that as she does age, her formidable anxiety is probably increasing. And just to know that you're dealing with an anxious woman who's really doesn't know how to deal with her own anxiety, that, you know, you can stand up for yourself and reassure your mother-in-law at the same time. Claire, thanks so much for your call. We're going to take a short break. We're talking about our in-laws with Terry Apter, a psychologist at the University of Cambridge in England and author of What Do You Want From Me? Learning to Get Along with Your In-Laws. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Support for WHYY comes from the Mainline Health Heart Center, where nationally recognized clinicians offer an array of treatments for cardiovascular disease, including minimally invasive robotic bypass surgery, laser interventional procedures that can stop a heart attack in its tracks, beating heart bypass surgery, and multiple options for the treatment of arrhythmia. The hospitals of the Mainline Health Heart Center, Bryn Mawr, Lankenau, Paoli, Riddle, and Bryn Mawr Rehab. Information online at mainlinehealth.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Jeff Muldaur of the Texas Sheiks. For decades, he's been reinterpreting blues and jazz of the 20s and 30s. He'll perform songs from his new album. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
My baby told me I would have to go. I can't be good no more. Once like I did before.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about our in-laws with Terry Apter, psychologist at the University of Cambridge in England, author of What Do You Want From Me? Learning to Get Along with Your In-Laws. We're talking about things from the in-laws' perspective. It is a great deal about anxiety over losing influence, losing connection. You know, I tell a story, Terry, I don't know if you're aware of this, I'm in a wheelchair. And when my grandson was little, my daughter, protective mom of a new baby, put him on my lap to hold him when she went downstairs to pack. And he started to squirm out of my lap, and I slowly eased him down to the carpeted floor. Well, he was a bit shaken up by it, and so was I, and he started to scream. And Debbie, my daughter, came running up and grabbed him and reassured him and took him downstairs, and there I was, you know, with my guilt and my helplessness.
Mm-hmm.
And I called her on the phone the next day, and I said, Debbie, this question probably doesn't need to be asked, but I need to ask it. I said, are you ever going to let me hold him on my lap again? And she said, of course I am. But just the fact that I raised the question talks about my realization that there really is a shift of power, of control here.
Yes.
You know, about my access to my precious grandson also.
Well, that's one of the most difficult things for grandparents to realize. First of all, there is this extraordinarily strong primitive tie, grandparent to grandchild. You know, for all sorts of genetic reasons, we really have, humans have developed with very strong ties to grandchildren. As a matter of fact, there's some evidence now that grandparents played a very important role in primitive societies, in early human societies. If your own parents were still living, then you had a much better chance of raising children to adulthood because there would be an extra pair of hands for childcare and food gathering, and there was an additional source of knowledge about raising children.
Well, that's
to adulthood.
I'm sure that's the case now to a very large extent.
But you don't have the legal power or the practical power or often the physical power that a parent has. And so, of course, your own child has this genetic tie to you, wants you to be very close to close to her own children. And it's easier for the maternal grandparents to have access to their children than it is for the paternal grandparents to have. You know, you can look and see how often do grandparents see their children, and maternal grandparents tend to have more access.
Back to those generalizations we were making earlier in this show. Let's hurry, see if we can get a couple more calls on. Let's go to line one and get Hank up on the line. Hey, Hank, you're on Voices.
Yeah, I'll just have some humor, maybe. I'm married 55 years. And my mother-in-law hated me. And she, we have 10 children, and she would talk to my children against me. But what I did, after her second time of taking pills, saying she was going to commit suicide, if she really wanted to, she wouldn't have made a phone call. So I made her come and live with us. And every morning, just to aggravate her, what I would do, not to aggravate her, but what I would do, I would overwhelm her with kindness. I would get the doily, put it in front of her. I would make the coffee. I would pour it for her, get her cup and tea. And I just would never allow her to interfere with my family just by treating her well, you know. And of course, when she passed away, it was me and my wife that were there with her and, you know, and helped her right along. I always respected her in spite of what she did to me because she was my wife's mother, and I had never, ever, ever spoken against her family to my mom. Hank, I mean, to my wife.
Hank,
and every other weekend, what we used to do was go to each other's parents for dinner, and then we would alternate the holidays. And the last thing is, I have 7 daughters, and when they were getting married, the week before plus the morning of the wedding, I would tell they're all very close. I would tell my future in-laws, sons-in-law, listen, don't come to me later on. I'm warning you now. First argument you had, the network's going to be working. So I teased them about it today, and kind of I just tell them they should respect each other. And I think it all comes, that's the bottom line. I could have disrespected my mother-in-law, but I didn't do that.
Yeah, it really is about respect. Hank, thanks so much for your thanks so much for your call. It's a great lesson for all of us. So, Terry, it is about respect, ultimately.
It's about the need for respect, the need for mutual respect.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that if you are really insistent and proactive in showing it, then you can waylay a mother-in-law who says awful things about you to your children and who uses that emotional blackmail of, you know, I'm going to kill myself if you don't do what I want or if you don't respect me. The fact that it worked for Hank, that, you know, he was so proactive, getting his mother-in-law to come and live with him and showing her every kindness. Not all of us are in a position to do that or willing to do that or would feel that, you know, that would be good for us. It worked for Hank. It's a remarkable story. You know, it's an emblematic story. But, of course, all of these things in every issue here, every individual has to weigh it up for himself or herself. What they can give, what they can allow.
I want to switch subjects with you for just a minute while we have time. Anybody who's practiced marital therapy or most have read or should read the work by John Gottman, probably the renowned researcher. You cited his work in your book specifically around how men and women deal with stressful interactions. Can you summarize that for us?
Well, often people say that men are better at direct conflict than women are, and women tend to sort of avoid conflict. When it comes to the family, when it comes to arguments and conflict within the family, the men actually are less good. When there's a stressful situation, interpersonal argument within the family, their blood pressure, their heart rate, their pulse, their adrenaline levels tend to rise much more rapidly than women's do. And in order to protect themselves from a stressful family situation, they often withdraw. It's called stonewalling because they turn themselves into a stone wall to protect themselves from the interaction that makes them very anxious or fills them with this physiological stress. Response.
So is it curable, or when we feel stressed, should we just go out and hunt some? Go out,
oh,
go
I
hunting.
Think, I think it's a something that can be addressed. I mean, women say, when I need you, to defend, to interact with me and defend and protect me and defend me when I'm with your in-laws, you seem to withdraw. If she can understand that he's doing that in order to protect himself, then she will realize that the way to get him to respond positively to her is not to attack him, but to reassure him that, you know, he's not being disloyal to people, that she's not attacking him. She just should be able to say, this is what I need from you. I need you to pay attention to me, to smile at me, compliment me, touch my hand. You know, I need that kind of response from you. And that's much better than saying, you know, you never defend me, you're never on my side, you're never around when I need you. So I think knowing the different response in interpersonal stress, knowing how men often do respond, that they do tend to close down, makes it better for women to deal with it.
So let me ask you to answer one last question in just the few seconds we have left.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't you putting the burden of responsibility here on women?
No, I think wherever there's trouble, even when it seems as though it's between the two women, it's always triangular. It always involves the man as well, and his role is crucial. And if he understands that, then he can do an awful lot to soften and avoid any conflict between his mother-in-law and his wife.
Well, with that, Terry Apter, I'm going to thank you so much for joining us. It's been a delightful show, and thanks for writing the book.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure being on your show.
Terry Apter is a psychologist at the University of Cambridge, and she has written What Do You Want From Me? Learning to Get Along with Your In-Laws. Next week on the show, we're going to be talking about the recovery-based model for mental health care. Much more about that next week. Well, you can reach us at voices@whyy.org, and you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. The show is produced by Gita Simons. Rich Banowitz directs the web at WHYY and Twittered throughout the show. Our intern is Jonathan Glick. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Mother-in-law, mother-in-law.
It's Monday afternoon.